I'd like to join with Tiffany and extend my thanks to the Philadelphia Society in general and Bill Campbell in particular for allowing me to come and speak. It was 20 years ago that I attended an ISI event in Baton Rouge commemorating the 75th anniversary of the Southern Review, which was edited by Robert Penn Warren and Cleanth Brooks. And it was at that meeting that I was able to meet Mr. Brooks, Russell Kirk, and the subject matter of my paper, Mel Bradford, and talk with these men at length. It was also at the Campbell home that I was able, at a farewell reception, to take a very blurry and out-of-focus picture of Mel Bradford and Russell Kirk shaking hands for the very last time. But I am glad that while my academic career has now come full circle to come and speak to the Philadelphia Society at Bill's request on Mel Bradford, Bill had the good sense of putting me, after 20 years, on a panel entitled Younger Generation. So thank you, Bill. It was 18 years ago last month that Emmy Bradford departed this life. He left behind an immense body of scholarly writing, political speeches, and by some accounts, a treasure trove of letters still untapped by historians of American conservatism. An affable and steadfast man with an inclination toward a baritone voice, as Bill reminded us yesterday, Bradford made his mark both physically and intellectually upon 20th century conservatism, most importantly in the study of literature, politics, history, the American South, and the American founding. His essays dotted conservative journals and magazines, and perhaps hundreds of conservative college students heard his lectures from the 1970s until the early 1990s, and I was privileged to hear one of the last. But unlike other key intellectuals of 20th century conservatism, Bradford's legacy has slowly drifted from our memory. This is not due to the subject matter of his writings, to the questions he raised about cherished icons of classical liberalism, John Locke, natural rights, Abraham Lincoln, equal opportunity, nor to his personal style of discourse. Rather, I would argue that Bradford's fading significance seems to have something to do with the absence of an institutional legacy. And it's perhaps one of the few disadvantages of the conservative movement's work with academic foundations and networks that unless one has serious students bent on furthering an institutional commitment to their mentor, it's unlikely that a person's contributions will be long remembered. There's only one serious scholarly treatment of Bradford's work, a Fletschrift edited by Clyde Wilson, entitled Defender of Southern Conservatism, Emmy Bradford and His Achievements, which was published in 1999 by the University of Missouri Press, and followed a Liberty Fund colloquium based on Bradford's writings. There is no Bradford Institute, nor a Bradford Forum of Scholars who begin their academic presentations with the opening lines, Mel used to say, as Dr. Bradford once told me, or even a generic, according to Bradford. Another cause could be that Bradford never produced in a single volume a magnum opus, or that the surroundings of his untimely death, as I understand it, have effectively placed his personal papers off limits. It is fitting, then, that a conference sponsored by conservatives and focused on American progressivism should also coincide with a brief tribute to Emmy Bradford. After all, perhaps Bradford's greatest contribution as a scholar and as a rhetorician in the classical sense was his challenge to progressive ideology in all of its myriad and ugly forms. Can I say ugly? Is that okay? Admittedly, it is not Bradford's published writing that continues to be read. Rather, it is his frame of mind and the understanding of his understanding of the accomplishments of the founding that I think may matter most. Now, if I may offer something of a departure, as many of us now realize, progressive-era intellectuals differed from each other in important ways. Progressive historians like Charles Beard or Frederick Jackson Turner did not always interpret American history in the same light as Woodrow Wilson or Herbert Crowley. Now, it's true, they all called into question generations of popular myths about the founding. Many of these myths had their roots in Whig partisan rhetoric of the antebellum period, and a few came from a dialectical reading of American history, a dialectical reading which was first popularized in the early 19th century by men like Richard Hildreth, George Bancroft, and Edward Everett. It does not take a deep reading of the progressives to realize that while they preferred the democratic tone taken by Jeffersonian Republicans and Jacksonian Democrats against the elitist ventures they thought of the Federalists and the Whigs, the progressive vision of control, of regulation, and civic responsibility matched most closely that of Henry Clay and Daniel Webster. That is to say, many progressives disliked the Federalist and Whig political style, but they accepted the outcome sought by many early American nationalists, such as a country marked by unanimity of principle, a lofty, if not mystical, view of political participation and union, and the development of an elite dedicated to the political allocation of the country's material and financial resources. Now, after World War II, and as the conservative movement emerged, historians took issue with the progressives in a variety of ways. Some, like Forrest MacDonald, conducted detailed research into the same archival and demographic evidence used by Beard and others to produce interpretations directly at odds with some progressive thinking. Others, not necessarily intellectual conservatives, took issue with the progressives for not realizing how united Americans were in the 18th century. For Daniel Boorstin, Bernard Balin, and many of his students, the American Revolution resulted less from financial concerns about taxation and trade and more from the world of ideas. Americans, they argued, shared a common ideological heritage, even though to this day no one has convincingly explained whether that heritage rested on republicanism, Lockean liberalism, Scottish humanism, the English common law tradition, or a combination of many other ideology or ism. What mattered for them was that Americans were united, and that the Framers' Constitution of 1787 rested on a shared ideological commitment to these various ideals. And many intellectual conservatives followed a similar path, though they were a little bit more open in emphasizing among the framers an ideological mix of natural rights philosophy, a compact theory of government, and something usually called a Judeo-Christian ethic. Though there again, no one has really satisfactorily explained what a Judeo-Christian ethic may be. Enter Mel Bradford. During the bicentennial years of the creation and ratification of the Constitution, Bradford delivered a series of public speeches concerning the founding. Together, these speeches turned into essays, which were published in a single volume at the time of his death. Now, Bradford claimed that he had the title in mind for this volume, which is Original Intentions on the Making and Ratification of the United States Constitution, many years prior to that volume's publication. Bradford intended that our eyes be drawn to the plurality of the term intentions. The several essays followed a definite pattern, beginning with his literary analysis of the convention itself and Madison's role as a classically comic figure tossed to and fro in the turbulent world of politics. Other essays included a treatment of the English common law tradition, analysis of specific state ratifying conventions like Massachusetts and South Carolina, and not to be ignored, an explication of the framers' religious beliefs. Now, I could stop here, and I'm sure Mark would really appreciate that, and I could stop here and say great things about how Mel Bradford anticipated the work of scholars that continued in the generation after his death. We could commend Bradford's foresight as he anticipated many of these new directions that scholarship would take. Both conservatives and mainstream academics have since then argued about Madison's role and his seemingly shifting position throughout his political career. A much fuller explication of the common law tradition developed in the 1990s and afterward, which gave us a renewed appreciation not only for the English common law, but how that common law tradition limited, if not compromised, the very idea of sovereignty within a society of numerous and competing jurisdictions. And I'll come back to that in a moment. The religious lives of the framers received detailed attention following Bradford's death. And while some scholars have challenged aspects of Bradford's interpretation, his overall thesis that the framers were hardly secularist who wished to rid American society of religious orthodoxy, I think has stood the test of time. Most recently, and perhaps most importantly, academic attention, and even public attention, has now shifted away from the Philadelphia Convention to the state ratifying conventions, which Bradford believed to be the real location of the Constitution's creation. Now, in the process, a remarkable thing has occurred over the past generation, something which I believe Bradford's writings had anticipated as early as the 1970s. Americans have rediscovered the Anti-Federalist, and the general public is now reading the writings of the Anti-Federalist. And while both academic and general reading of the Anti-Federalist may not be exactly accurate, nonetheless, the Anti-Federalists are no longer seen as merely men of little faith, but those who had a positive contribution to the founding. Now, Bradford's insistent that the founders ratify the same Constitution for separate and distinct reasons, making it necessary that we must talk about Virginia's Constitution or Massachusetts' Constitution and so forth. This appears to be an understanding that is no longer confined to Southern conservatives. Bradford challenged the progressive insistence that the founding no longer mattered. And while doing so, he challenged with equal vigor the vision of an ideologically united society free of economic and moral divisions that both progressives and many conservatives hoped to achieve. So Bradford was simultaneously anti-progressive, anti-liberal, anti-consensus, and in some ways, perhaps, anti-mainstream conservative. Perhaps it could even be argued that Bradford was anti-ideology in all of its forms. Now, while we may quarrel with these new interpretations that have followed from Bradford's death, or we may disagree on the consequences, or even with Bradford's beliefs in general, I would should argue to you that one thing does seem certain. Whether new scholars are reading Mel Bradford is not so much the point as it is that Bradford's perspectives on the Revolutionary and founding era are on the rise, and for the moment, it seems, are in no danger of subsiding anytime soon. To emphasize Bradford's insistence about the plurality of intentions, however, I must agree, can lead us all astray. Postmodern historians and political scientists are apt, in fact, they seem to enjoy, arguing that because agreement on the Constitution was absent in the 1780s, there was then no such thing as original intent, and therefore the Constitution can mean whatever we want it to mean. Such was not the reasoning behind Bradford's contentions. As he noted in the preface to Original Intentions, and I quote here at length, "The Constitution of the United States is a rich heritage of agreements, elevated to the level of definitive act, but without inflation into ideology and armed doctrine. It organizes and protects a government able to contain our multiplicity without setting out to resolve it. It does not manipulate our conflict over values towards some extrinsic anterior goal. Rather, it tells us all that we are obliged to settle such questions in society," emphasis added by Bradford, "in society, minus the coercions of law and politics." Bradford's concern about establishing authority and legitimacy for any regime, and he wrote about this throughout his career, should not be confused with an assistance of centralizers like the progressives, that human institutions possess a degree of sovereignty equal to that originally attributed to God. And while Bradford did not explicitly state this case, his writings still remind us that when sovereignty is placed in the people, it necessarily restricts all vestiges of institutional power, not just in politics. For Bradford, the genius of the American founding was American federalism, which itself is about fostering a country of parallel societies that take an almost infinite variety of forms, and none of which can hold an absolute claim upon the others. It's a recognition perhaps, that in a society where everyone is sovereign, no one really is. And admittedly, this is a very difficult concept for us to wrap our minds around, especially wrap our minds around the circumstances and effects of sovereignty in the people, or what the founding generation, by purpose or by accident, had actually achieved. Now, I believe Bradford did as good a job as Edmund Morgan or Joyce Appleby or the late Lance Banning or any historian and political scientist have done with this. Yet it should be considered that the problems we might have with Bradford's understanding may have less to do with his interpretation than with an ongoing development of American federalism and the virtues required for sustaining it. As we consider the long-term implications of American progressivism, we should also remember what Bradford tried to teach us. The threats posed by the progressives had deep roots that stretched far into the earliest recesses of American memories, perhaps even dated to the founding itself. And for Bradford, perhaps even to the earliest days of colonial settlement. Thank you.